You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
There's a chance that one day we humans could have a conversation with whales. Let me explain. Scientists tapping into artificial intelligence are working to decipher what a whale's clicking sounds mean so we can get a grasp of their language and use it to communicate with these mysterious underwater marvels. But what should we say? What could they tell us? And what if it turns out whales don't really like us? I'm Melissa Duggan, and this is The Big Story. Ross Anderson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thrilled to chat with you. This is a wild concept that we humans could one day talk to whales. How did this pop up on your radar?
Yeah, I mean, apart from just like being a sort of new agey kid and wishing for this, I'm part of this thing called the Multi-Species Constitution Project, which is sponsored by the Berggruen Institute. And it's a kind of collective of writers and scientists and constitutional scholars who are trying to frame a constitution that could have as its, I guess, constituents or whatever, both humans and any other species on Earth. Very, very ambitious project. And one of the people in it is this guy named David Gruber, who runs this project, SETI. He's a marine biologist. And he and I were out having drinks in LA at one of the multi-species constitution meetings, and he told me this, just started telling me about his work, which I found so fascinating. And this is that, you know, in artificial intelligence research, there's this award called the Turing Award, which is kind of like the Nobel for AI. And he and like two Turing Award winners had started this project, SETI, which is an effort to decode sperm whale language. And I said, tell me more. That sounds fascinating. I'm writing a book that bears some relation to the subject matter. And so I was hooked. I was in.
Why are scientists specifically looking at sperm whales and how do they communicate?
It's a great question. So, you know, lots of whales seem to communicate in quite evocative ways. Most famously, the humpback whales. You know, in the 1970s, Roger Payne famously recorded their songs, the humpback whale songs, and put them on, I guess, a vinyl record at the time that did serious numbers, did One Direction numbers, and really was kind of part of the impetus to end whaling, which of course had been disastrous for whales on planet Earth for, you know, the previous two centuries. And since then, I think there's been a lot of interest in all cetacean communication. So that includes dolphins and the kind of noises they make. And of those communication styles, it appears, at least for now, and I just want to be really clear in everything we talk about today, that so much is unknown about these animals and their communication styles. But it appears for now, like the sperm whale's clicking sounds, they make these clicks kind of in these like machine gun patterns, that they have the most potential for syntax, for having kind of like rules and, you know, potentially stringing together something that could be analogous to a very simple sentence. And so that obviously has attracted attention from not just people who study whales, but also linguists and philosophers of language. And yeah, so that's why sperm whales are sort of the kind of the first animals, you know, beyond the primates, you know, for whom we've already tried and so forth. They're the best candidate, I think, right now for another animal whose language we can decipher.
What's the process like for decoding this whale language?
It's difficult, but we get a huge boost from AI. So the basic idea is that, just if I can get technical for a second, if you think about a large language model like the one that ChatGPT runs on, right? The way it works is that you dump a bunch of human language into it, you know, basically the whole internet, and it learns to spit out strings of words that seem to be make a lot of sense. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of controversy over whether or not it is able to understand language when it does so. But either way, we know it has this ability to kind of pump out these strings of language that makes sense. And so the idea is, if we could record enough sperm whale clicks, and, you know, David Gruber and Project SETI are in the process of doing this with a whole network of floating microphones in the Caribbean, that you could then dump them into a large language model, basically, and get them to start generating the clicks, basically sequences of clicks, just like ChatGPT generates sequences of words. And that would be the first step in potentially decoding their language. Now, you tell me if you want to hear more.
Yeah, please tell me more. Let's take a deep dive.
Yeah, so to speak. So right now, AI cannot translate between two languages unless it has a translation sample, a Rosetta Stone. But it's getting better and better at doing it with like very few translation samples. You know, you can give it like a few pages of a translated work and then all of a sudden it can, you know, it figures out the rest just based on the kind of like structural similarity between the two languages. And there's some hope that by observing the whales, so for instance, like they seem to make specific clicking sounds right before they dive. And it seems to some like they're arranging babysitting for their calves because they go on these really long 45-minute dives down. They hunt giant squid like in the dark zones in the ocean. Very cool, very metal. But if you could observe, you know, where you have this idea of like, well, maybe the clicking sounds mean this. If you could string together, you know, a few of those into kind of like a very limited and crude Rosetta Stone, there's a hope that then iteratively you could build up a bigger one by letting AI do the work. So then you get AI to say, well, actually, we think the other one means this. And then you go test that with observation and go back and you keep iterating until you can fill out a whole Rosetta Stone.
So let's say that all of this works out. We are able to communicate with this whole other species. In your piece in The Atlantic, you examine an interesting question. If all this works, what would we say? How did you go about finding an answer to that question?
Yeah, you know, I tried to, you know, I have my own notions, but I tried to ask a lot of people. And in particular, I was interested first to hear from people who spend a lot of time with these animals, or at least spend a lot of time, you know, observing these animals from a safe distance, I should say. And, you know, I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to talk to philosophers. I wanted to talk to people who care about animal rights. I just, you know, really started calling anyone who might have any expertise on this subject and saying, you know, just what you asked me. Like, okay, you know, say we've got this shot. And again, to stress, it would take much difficult work to get there. But if we have this shot, you know, what should we say to the whales?
And what kind of answer did you get?
Yeah, so, you know, the most common one, and I, you know, as this story has been shared across social media, you can see this time and again, is that we should start with sorry. You know, I mean, these are animals whose numbers we decimated just absolutely brutally during whaling. You know, it's one of the kind of really, really awful aspects of the Industrial Revolution is the way that we just absolutely tore through whale populations globally. And so
we do owe them an apology.
We owe them an apology. And yeah, in fact, I often think, I've been thinking lately about, like, you know, the grandmother whales, the sperm whales, you know, are in these matrilineal units. And the grandmother whales are old enough to have been alive for whaling and for its cessation. So I guess I'm really curious as to, like, the story that they tell themselves about that, you know, like when whaling went away, like what did they think? Oh, wow, these humans, you know, that now they're enlightened and benevolent. Probably not. Maybe they have some other reason. But yeah, I think an apology is certainly a great place to start, you know, just like start there, like, hey, we did this really awful thing and we realized it and we're happy we realized it, but we of course realized it entirely too late. And we want to apologize for that.
Who or what would be the ideal messenger to begin this conversation?
Yeah. So, you know, I looked at a lot of options for this. And like, so, you know, there are playback experiments in the wild where, you know, with various kinds of animals, not just whales, people set up kind of remotely operated speakers to test what the animals will do if they hear some communication of theirs from their species or from another. And that didn't feel quite right for like actual communication to me. You know, I worried if you just stuck a big speaker in the water and started playing these whales' language that, you know, they might like mistake that for like a whale god or something. Or, you know, this communication style is meant to travel distances, you know, from whales that are out of visual reach, right? So I figured like, maybe the whales would, in that case, they would think that, oh, if this is like one of our clan members, you know, and he's like, he's so far away or she's so far away. And so I feel like we should do this in person. So it's clear who the communication is coming from. But as I say in the piece, I, I don't think we should send a man because I don't think we want to quarter a lone whale. And the groups of whales are called units. You know, they travel together. It's like 10 to 15 of them usually are matrilineal. So it's grandmothers and mothers and calves. And when the males reach adolescence, they're kind of told to get lost. So I feel like if we sent a man, it's sort of the medium could be the message. It could be totally off-putting. So I think it should be a woman.
What are the risks or potentially harmful effects that could come from a talk between potentially this woman and whales?
Yeah, I mean, there are all manner of risks, right? Like, I mean, there are risks to the messenger herself. Like, for instance, if sperm whales, you know, we don't know what they think of human beings. So they seem, when they encounter us in the water now, they're not, the young ones tend to be more curious about humans. The older ones seem to act sort of indifferent to us. That may change, but they don't really attack humans ever. There's like very few recorded instances of that. They seem to be just kind of let us be on our way. If, however, we started clicking their language at them, you know, of course, one would hope that they would find this to be a wondrous first encounter, a bridging across the two species with language.
That sounds beautiful.
It does, but maybe on the other hand, they'd be totally horrified by it. You know, maybe they would think like this is some dark magic, you know, that humans have brought into the sea, or that it was just entirely inappropriate. Like we have no concept of kind of their cultural or their mental states, right? And so that's certainly one dangerous aspect. The other one is really that, you know, just like ChatGPT hallucinates, by which I mean, you know, make stuff up, we won't really know for 100% sure that our translations are accurate until we test them on the whales. Right. And so if we thought we were saying something like, hello, we come in peace. And in fact, we were saying, you know, your leader is going to kill you all. That could create like genuine social disruption within whale world. And, you know, the animal rights people that I talked to were really keen for that not to happen. I think we'd have to be very careful there.
Okay. So we've got to be cautious. Given all of that, what should our opening line be?
Yeah. Well, so the sperm whales, you know, they tend to have this, what's called so the clicking sequences they make are called codas, C-O-D-A-S. And, you know, they have one that seems to be, again, unknown for now, but seems to be a social identity marker because they're shared among their clans, and their clans can be up to 10,000 animals. And they don't meet up all at one time ever, these 10,000 animals, but they are kind of like a single cultural group, and they'll overlap in the ocean with other clans. Right? Other clans of sperm whales and never interact with each other. So it's like an ethno-linguistic group. One of the scientists explained it to me as being like English speakers and French speakers in Montreal, right? Like I'm sure they interact with each other, but they tend to like socialize with one another, right? And the whales are the same way. And so they have what seems to be kind of like a clan coda. So my thought was that maybe you start with that, right? Because it would certainly be attention getting, you know, because that's like, they don't really communicate with other animals that use different clan codas. And so maybe that's your opener, is to be like, hey, you know, we're part of your clan, or at least in some metaphorical way, or at least we recognize that's how you greet each other.
Now, some signals from other species have already been decoded, and you list a few like honeybees and monkeys. What lessons have we learned there?
Yeah, I mentioned those two decodings really to illustrate that we have to hope that the sperm whales have a pretty expansive vocabulary, at least a more expansive vocabulary than the honeybees or the monkeys whose alarm calls we've decoded. Because, you know, despite through much observation having done these decodings in the case of those two species, they haven't really led to like a super complicated or interesting dialogue between our species, right? Because they don't say many things. It's just like humpback whale song is a kind of interesting parallel case. Like most of the theory suggests that there's not a really, even though the songs can be like super complex, they appear to just mean like, let's mate for most, you know, like primarily.
Just down to basics.
Yeah, down to basics. And so that doesn't leave room for like a really rich conversation. And so, well, it's wondrous to even be able to decode these really limited vocabularies from, if it's even right to call them vocabularies, these calls from these animals. they're not giving up. We aren't going to have rich conversations unless an animal like the sperm whale or some of the rumbling noises that elephants make, unless there are really sort of complicated syntax there.
So let's say we can have a more complex interaction with the sperm whale. What kind of information could they offer?
I think one of the byproducts of talking to so many scientists for this piece is that a lot of them are just so curious about the animals themselves, right? Which is, I thought, really lovely. And so a lot of their questions, what they wanted to talk about with the sperm whales was just like, tell me about your life, you know, like, what are your desires? What do you value most? And then there are all these kind of, you know, fascinating details. Like, I loved it. One of the scientists wanted to know, like, what is it like to swim through a hurricane? You know, it's a fascinating question, you know, and how many squid are there down in the dark zones where really humans very infrequently go? You know, what's that like? What is that experience like of diving down in the dark? Just getting like the texture of their everyday lives, I think would be really fascinating.
What if we don't like what they have to say? What if sperm whales are jerks?
Yeah, it's such a great question. Like I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's natural for us to romanticize these animals, right? And think of them as being, you know, these sort of peaceful and sort of semi-mystical giants. But as I was just saying, like, they're kind of xenophobic towards members of their own species. You know, like, even different clans, like, they don't really socialize with them. So it's entirely possible that they're like, hey, get out of here. Like, don't talk to me. And in which case, I think we'd have to respect that, right? That they wanted their space. I mean, there's another sort of great line of thinking along these lines is dolphins, right? Like, some dolphins in the wild are extreme jerks. And yet, because of this really, like, simple thing, which is, like, the way their mouth is cut on, like, their nose, we all think of the dolphin as being this, like, jolly fellow, you know, because it looks like they're smiling. But it's just, like, an anatomical thing. It doesn't mean that they're actually, like, really happy or certainly especially happy to see humans.
What about our side of the chat? What could humans share with whales?
Yeah, you know, I really in my sort of flights of fancy and working out this piece, I really was drawn to the idea of kind of catching them up on what they'd missed since they left dry land. You know, the fascinating thing to me about whales always is that, like us, they were part of the same lineage that came out of the water. They lived out of the water for some 300 million years, a little bit more than that. And then 55 to 50 billion years ago, for reasons that we don't know, they decided to go back in, actually somewhere near present-day Pakistan. And so it's fascinating to me that they made that choice. I actually have a Portuguese water dog at home, and I always think of him as being like a proto-whale if he had his way. But but yeah, and so I just wonder what we could tell them about, you know, our world, especially as it bears on theirs. Everything we figured out about nature and the universe, to the extent that we could cram that into whale language, I would think it would be pretty beautiful to share that.
Would you like to interview a whale?
It'd be great. It'd be great. What about you? Probably be a better podcast guest than me.
No, you've been terrific. And I look forward to that Atlantic piece if you ever make that connection.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Ross Anderson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. That was The Big Story. For more, visit thebigstorypodcast.ca. Feedback is very welcome. We'd love to hear your suggestions for a future episode. You can always email us at hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca or call us. Our number is 416-935-5935. Joseph Fish is the lead producer and Robin Simon is the producer of The Big Story. Stephanie Phillips is our showrunner. Mary Jubrin is our digital editor. Diana Kay is our manager of business development. Sound design for The Big Story is handled this week by Ryan Clark. The Big Story podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. Like us, rate us, review us, share us with a friend, would you? Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Duggan, in for Jordan Heath Rawlings. Jordan will be back on Monday.